You learn from how people manage from within. I was on a sewing machine just like the other ladies. I was folding underwear just like the other ladies. I learned a lot about doing by being on the floor and learning those lessons. But treating people fairly, with respect, has got to be the biggest thing I learned in almost everything I did. Everything.
Welcome to Voices of Leadership, my podcast that tells the stories of women who are redefining success and thriving on the edge of change. Today, I'm joined by an individual whose roots in our community runs as deep as her impact, Joan Fisk. This past May, Joan was the recipient of the 2025 Oktoberfest Women of the Year Lifetime Achievement Award. Joan is a powerhouse leader. Her incredible career began right here at her family business, the Tiger Brand Knitting Company. It's a place that holds a surprising bit of fashion history. If you're like me and you wore anything from Cotton Ginny or owned a Beaver Canoe t-shirt in the 80s, you were likely wearing a piece of Joan's legacy. As the current CEO of the United Way, Joan is now focused on strengthening the fabric of our community. I was curious to have this conversation because, like most people, I know what the United Way is and I can recognize its logo, but I didn't fully understand its unique funding model and the many ways it helps a community. Joan explains it as this: the United Way is a little bit from a lot of people to make a difference for people you don't even know. Joan also shares her perspective on leadership through the stories of her career. There is something for everyone to learn in this episode. Please enjoy Joan Fisk.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about the whole concept of your story, which is leader, and leadership is doing and modeled behavior, which is really what you do as a mother and a father. And you know that the tone at the top has to be connected and organized, because that's another story around the leadership world. If the organization doesn't have a cohesive voice, it doesn't work. So you live it as well as talk about it.
We do. And it's, you know, and they talk about the balance. And I don't think there's work-life balance per se, but you have to also model, I think you have to model working. Like it's like I get up and I do these things and you get up and you do the, I don't just sit around and to see me working, or I can't do this because I do have to do this. And I think those are good lessons for them too. And you can still be there, but still show them that you have things that sometimes take priority.
Oh, you have to have balance, mm-hmm. and you have to have some barriers. Otherwise you'd be a wreck.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, one of the things that I, you know, you're talking about, you've had four careers. You may have another, you don't know.
I never know.
You never know.
I'm super open to it. I just don't know.
I didn't have a clue that I would get here. It was Frank Boss who at the time had a leadership role at Toyota. Frank ended up as the president of Toyota North America, but he was the chair of the board of a combined United Way and knew of me, didn't know me, and obviously I wasn't part of this and I hadn't applied for a job for sure, but I was still chairing the local health integration network for Waterloo, Wellington, which was the LIN, and the LIN is the funding model for healthcare. So it was an interesting job because it worked with the government. I ended up chairing all the 14 LINs across the province. So I really had a great understanding of dishevelment, what bureaucracy is and isn't, and how we could fund healthcare, because as you know, there's never enough. And before that, which is when I met many people, I was the CEO at the Chamber of Commerce.
Oh,
in Kitchener.
Yes. Okay.
And when I took on that role, I had newly exited, well, it wasn't so new. I had exited Tiger Brand in 2006 when the company was sold. Mm-hmm. I chose not to go with the new owners who were out of New York, but it was a Chinese enterprise, mostly because I had two brothers in the business. And as coming from a family business, you'd understand the family business has a lot of good things about it and a lot of barriers to success. And the barrier to success for me was my gender. Because at the time when I became the president of the company, I was 37, female, in an era in 1988 when female leadership was an afterthought, only if there wasn't a guy. Being a girl, you know.
I do. I know all too well.
So I chose not to continue with it. So I did some consulting. I worked for a contract at Disney down in LA. Then I went up to New York to work for Ann Taylor to help them with opening their factory stores, because at that time they were just doing that kind of stuff. And I worked with a bridal company here in the Toronto area called Inez DeSanto, and which is kind of bespoke wedding gowns. And I worked with a couple of other small businesses to try and really help them form a business plan. which is when I took over the chamber, being asked by the chair of their board at the time, who was a lawyer that I knew quite well, who worked with me at Tiger Brand. So he was the chair of the board of the chamber. And I loved Ross. And he said, what do you think about running the chamber? I said, I don't know anything about running a chamber. He says, you know how to run a factory, Joan. You know how to run a chamber. I said, there's 12 people. I've got 1,200 people. What? How are you going to do this?
I'm kind of interesting. I didn't know you ran the chamber. I wouldn't even know what the job description of that is. Like what are they looking for in someone to run a chamber of commerce?
Why I took it on was because I loved Ross and I thought working with him, he was the chair of the board, working with him would be a very interesting opportunity, and they needed a turnaround. It was in financial distress, and I'm good at balance sheet and financial stuff. So I thought, well, I certainly can help. But what it taught me, Amy, of all of the leadership lessons I've had, and this one was probably one of the toughest ones, is that the chair of the board was not Ross Wells anymore. The chair of the board was a woman who had applied for the job. And they left her as chair of the board.
Oh, that couldn't have been a great start.
Oh, my goodness. And I didn't have any expectation, but I didn't have an expectation of bitterness, rivalry, anger. I didn't see it coming. I was blindsided by it. But it was the law of governance would be that would be absolutely a conflict right from the get-go.
Yes.
And I was surprised that these very high level folks within the community didn't see that. I had been at the time on the board. Maybe I'm still on the board at Laurier at the time. I think I was. I was also on the board of Canada's Technology Triangle. I was on the board of Core Mutual. So I was doing a lot of things on the side as well. I'd come off the board of Conestoga. I had a lot of board work experience, but I hadn't experienced the other side, the executive in the boardroom. Mm-hmm. That was a new experience for me, and I didn't expect it to be adversarial, and I didn't expect it to be quite as tricky, difficult. But when you work with someone that wants to see you fail, it's different than working with someone that just doesn't like you because you're their sister or they've got different ideas or. It was very different. So I learned a whole bunch of different lessons around strength, resiliency, fear, incredulous thoughts that went, what? But I've set it aside to learn how to change a balance sheet, how to get a financial, they didn't have an accounting firm that had credibility. So we added KPMG to the list and I knew them through the Gore. So I added some of the strength of my contacts into that organization to help stabilize it and move it forward. I did it for 2 years. My husband broke his back limbing a tree at the cottage. Oh. We have a cottage at North Lake Joseph in the Muskoka area, south of Parry Sound. And he ended up in the hospital in Parry Sound for almost a month.
That's awful. I'm so sorry.
So it was a good exit time. But it was also the right thing to do because the leadership on the board, when it's bad, a nonprofit can be really bad. And that was one of the lessons that I learned from that one. More lessons to come in that world.
That's interesting because as the CEO, the health of the board is so important.
Critical.
To that type of organization, but you don't have a lot of control over how the board is made up. So that's got to be a challenge as well.
It is a challenge. It continues to be a challenge in the nonprofit sector because I have a lot of colleagues that struggle with it and I'm no different. I struggle too. But what I learned a little bit about leading is listening. Because you also end up hearing different things from one time to the next. You hear somebody says this one thing. And as you know, listening can seek out those inconsistencies. And it teaches you, you need to be consistent in the message that you deliver. But I learned a lot of lessons in that job. And I thought I knew it all after 30 years in textiles.
Surprise.
Surprise is right. Surprise is right. But I learned then that there are some forms of female leadership, as you ask about the ceiling, glass ceiling or cement ceiling, as it's often referred to. Mm-hmm. It's also that some women are not great with women. It's not my style. I'm more of a hands-up person. But there's some women in that early years where the air is pretty rarefied. There's not a lot of room for female leadership. So it's very coveted and that ladder get kicked out, not hand up. And I learned that. I learned it the hard way, but I learned it as something I would never do.
And that's good too. The more of us that don't do it, the better, because we sort of expect the male barrier that's normal for that. We come up with ways to, you know, overcome those things. And sometimes when you come up against what you mentioned with a female leader, it's a little more hurtful and surprising because you would expect the opposite.
And you see it, yes, you do expect the opposite, but you also see it in organizations. And if you're not aware and really keep your senses really fine-tuned, you will sometimes miss those small nuances, because particularly in the nonprofit sector, there's a lot of women that work in this field. Mm-hmm. And they work in this field because they're compassionate often, because they have feelings of supporting a community or a cause or any of the things that we do, but they're lower paid.
Yes.
And it's a really big mistake and a misnomer that charity work shouldn't be paid the same as others. It's very Calvinistic if you think about it, mm-hmm. you know, but we struggle through it. And one of the mandates I had when I took on this combined role was to reduce the number of staff through attrition, partly through reorganizing jobs, but to pay less people more money.
Oh, wow. That's very refreshing. And have you had success with that?
Yes. I had 42 when I started. I have 17 or 18, depending, with 4 students.
Congratulations.
So, but it's partly the work of a factory. Well, you know, if you're mm-hmm. working in the car business, you know the same thing. Efficiency is critical, but managing process, supply chain is a good part of it. But this is a different thing in the people side. You have to be lean, but you have to be smart and be efficient in the way you work. So I just applied those same kind of constraint theory work that I had done in a factory and added it to this. And this is my, I don't know, maybe 5th job. I'm not sure. I think it's my last. I don't know.
But I don't know. I don't believe that.
But I am building a strong organization that will succeed me. The challenge, of course, is I took it over just before a pandemic, which upended the whole concept of philanthropy.
Yes.
Philanthropy is a funny word. We talk about it in lots of ways, but what we don't think, we see it in big numbers. We see a philanthropist as a very big, wealthy, private, you know, big company, big person, big family thing. But that's not what philanthropy is. Philanthropy is a little bit from a lot of people that make a community powerful and strong. And that's what United Way is. We have about 80 funded agencies that we support in the community. We're one of the organizations, probably the only organization, and it's a worldwide organization where people give a little bit. So the philanthropy model is a little bit off your paycheck. You hardly feel it. In fact, you really don't. And you're contributing to something that makes you feel good. Giving makes you feel good. It's even when you're working on a hockey charity, when you're selling tickets for something or other, it makes you actually feel proud and good. So one of the reasons that I took on this role coming out of healthcare funding was that I could see where so many things, small grassroots organizations, were falling through the cracks. And they are the backbone of our communities. We cannot ignore the fact that we have so many people coming in all the time. Canada is built on immigration. Good heavens. And will continue, even though we have a bit of a slowdown at the moment. This is something that you had to be able to assimilate and understand. And that's what I hoped to do when I got here to the United Way. It's such a shock to my system.
There you go. I agree. So let's talk a little bit more about the United Way, because I think that most of us can recognize the United Way logo and we understand that it's a charity.
Can you see all this behind me?
And look at lovely behind you. It's such a lovely media room. But I'm not sure. It's not always obvious what your purpose is. So what can you tell us a little bit? What is the United Way and how does it help communities like ours?
Well, the community has significant issues, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a global movement of organizations that are deeply local. So we focus on where the biggest needs are, whether it is mental health today, not so much in the past in the same way, but today, or shelter, or. We take a look at the organization, the community as a whole, as opposed to one specific thing. So United Way is built as an organization that built out of the post-war world, where it was called the community chest, where you would give a little bit to this fund that would then support the community. And there would be the red feather drive or all these things. And you'd see a thermometer in the middle of the city saying, this is how much money you kind of were getting to. But what we did was we were pretty well the only thing. And small grassroots organizations didn't have a fundraising arm. We were their fundraising arm. We were the ones that raised the money that would create the grant. And there wasn't the same government support as there is today, but there was also nowhere for small organizations to come together past the church. So United Way was built on that in the 20s and 30s. And it was nonpartisan. It was given a chance to give an equal amount of support across the community. Today is more complex. Today, all organizations do some fundraising on their own. Not all, but some do. But that's never enough. And so we have a grant mechanism where people apply to a grant for four different particular quarters a year, where we adjudicate those grant applications. And because we have a team of experts and volunteer adjudicators, we are able to put the money where we think it'll make the biggest impact. And that's what we do. So if it's House of Friendship, for instance, where they're running very specific programs that they wouldn't be able to run without a United Way grant, then that's what we provide. Because cities and communities and government change it on up and down, and there's money, there's no money, you can't have it. You apply for a grant, you don't know. If you're in that world, you'd know what I'm talking about. United Way is built on stability, but it's with huge challenge today. The challenge of a United Way workplace campaign is that the leaders are who make the difference, aren't standing up and saying, we collectively will do a United Way campaign this fall, and you can take $10 off your pay this for every 2 weeks, and you will contribute, and we will match it, and we will be a big partner and a strong supporter of our community. We thought that that would be a model that was appealing to people. But the pandemic hit, and a lot of the leaders decided they wouldn't, and the millennial generation said, you can't tell me as a leader who to give to. I want to choose. If I want to give to the Humane Society, I will. But what it has illustrated is that less people give generally. So when leaders don't lead, there is less given out to the community. And this model was built on this idea of making sure that we could collect a lot of small voices to make it one really big, powerful voice. So that's what United Way is.
It's so interesting. There's a few things. So it is a very different charitable model, but also I didn't know about the post-war history. So that's such an interesting piece of information. I really didn't know that. So I think that's really neat how it came out of the war and it came out, you know, to provide for communities and that it was the only one and things have changed so much. And the other thing I found interesting is when you talk about charitable organizations and how much a leader in an organization can affect a charitable organization. I'm not sure many people view it like that. And maybe the people that are leading today don't even know that they have the power and their voice to do that, I wonder.
They do. I don't know. The leaders today are slightly different. But one of my first experiences with Bob Astley, and he at the time was the president of Mutual. And the Mutual was a mutual life insurance company and provided benefits, and it had mutual shareholders. So that mutual organization demutualized and became Clarica, and then Clarica was taken over by Sun Life. The leaders at Clarica or Sun Life were the ones that would say to their employees, this is what we do as an organization, you're our big voice. And Bob, I got to know a little bit through other ways, but he was a leader. And he taught me a little bit about the power of charity, the power of philanthropy, and how important it is. Nonprofits, they are the biggest employer in Canada.
Interesting. That makes sense. Yeah.
You know, $5 billion in the last 4 years have been donated to Canadian charities through United Way. It's not just a nothing little thing, but in our region, in Waterloo region, it's not well understood. It was. We had Bud Automotive, Schneider's, Lear Seating, Manufacturing, Uniroyal, Furniture Making, Boot Making, Shoe Making, Button Making, yeah. You name it. We were a community of manufacturers. And people that worked in factories could be one paycheck away from needing a United Way. And so they understood the model. They understood the health net. And that's really what it still is today. But it is not understood by the leadership because they don't take the time. Technology changed that. When I first met Jim Balsillie, he was on a board with me at Laurier. We had just joined a newly Dean's Advisory Council. So this young fellow was sitting beside me in our very first meeting, and Bob Astley was the chair. And there was a couple of other folks around the table and a few professors. And I said, no, where do you work? He said, oh, I work for Sutherland Schultz for Brock Solutions. So before Jim was Sir Jim. But I got to see how that early startup mentality. Recently, he says to me, why would you run a charity? Huh? I don't understand it. And the leader of today is a big time leader. Big philanthropists want to give $5 million to a program just recently at Laurier, for instance. And I think he's amazing. And he and Mike, what they did with BlackBerry and all the other people that they led here in our community around leadership are great. But they scale up. They do well. A lot of them keep going. And they don't give back because they're on their own. They do this on their own. They live in a different world. So thinking about giving back to them is when they make it big and they can do something big and they can put something with their name on it. But this is not United Way. United Way is a little bit from a lot of people to make a difference for people that you don't even know. You don't see that mom that is staying in a marriage or even partnership, getting beaten up, nowhere else to go. We support children's food programs at both through Food for Kids and Nutrition for Learning because, shockingly, there are people that open a refrigerator and there's nothing in it or nothing really of value in it. And we are looking at a responsibility and putting responsibility on these small organizations that never have enough. So having a grant for United Way really makes a difference. It's a big lift. And I'm so proud sometimes when I can go and visit these organizations, whether it's Citizenship Court, whether it's literacy. Literacy is such a big piece that you don't see.
It's a starting point for everything, really.
It is. In fact, a very funny story recently, Amy, is that our dear little airport down the road called us up and said, we've got all these lost and found items and we don't know what to do with them. And people don't come and get them. And nobody really wants to sort through these massive boxes of this shit. Excuse my language. Would you come and get it? Sure, we can be the garbage disposal and sort through it. But in it was 140 pairs of prescription sunglasses or prescription glasses. And I thought, what are we going to do with those? So we called up Chris Prosser over at Literacy. I said, Chris, what do you do with leftovers? You give them to me right now. He was over to pick them up the next day. Because people could come in and try them on and figure out that because they don't have any glasses. Mm-hmm. So these are the little tiny things that you don't always see that you don't know what difference it makes when you can make a difference. When you do kit packing for homeless shelters where we get people working together as a team building exercise and the team building exercise produces some really great work. So United Way provides some great things within companies, organizations, but it also gives your community some safety. The more people we can get off the street, the safer it is. The more people that we can help with mental health problems, the safer it is. And mental health and addiction is getting worse and worse. The addiction piece, I'm not sure the solution. I really am not. But I also sit on the board of the College of Physicians and Surgeons. I sit on their executive. And in that role, I've been able to see addiction happening at every walk of life.
It doesn't discriminate, that's for sure.
It does not. And it's not like in the 30s and the 40s, the alcoholic fellows on the side of the street. It's not that.
No.
It's not shell shock. It's PTSD. It's a completely different evolution of what our community is involved in. And that's what United Way has taught me. It's taught me where to be empathetic, where I can make a difference, where we can encourage people to know and support their community a little bit. And so we concentrate now on individual donors more than just the workplace campaign, which is not sustainable. Because if people don't want to give, they won't give. And if the leaders don't tell them they have to give, they certainly won't give because they think they can't.
Well, the eyeglass story is very telling. It really does explain how it works. And so that's hopefully very helpful for people to hear. And you've talked a little bit about the challenges of fundraising. And then you just mentioned sort of switching to individual donors in addition to the company model, which is no longer sustainable, and things change at the pandemic. So is this sort of where you go forward? And is this today's effective way of fundraising? Because you've been involved on boards for a very long time. You've probably seen the funding model change over the years from mm-hmm. what it was. Companies a great example to not, and leadership. And so what does fundraising look like today?
Fundraising looks like storytelling, you know, of really getting involved in the heart of many stories, lots of slivers in our community. And you can dive into ones that are uniquely interesting to some donors, to major donors, particularly around mental health. Food, for instance, food insecurity is not just going to a food bank, because our Waterloo Region Food Bank is not a retail food bank. You don't go to the food bank and pick up some groceries. In Cambridge, there is the self-help food bank that we do support as well. And we help with those programs. But food is just one of the many levers that we can pull and push and use that wheelbarrow to help in our community. And that's what United Way does. We collect a lot from different people for different reasons, and they can direct it. They can say, my interest is in X. My interest is in immigration. My interest is in helping people settle. My interest is in immigration, or it's in Indigenous issues, or it's in gay rights. It could be a million different things that people have interest in, and we can then redirect to that in collection with other people to make a bigger impact. So we bundle it all together and get it to where we think we can make a difference. Does that make sense to you?
It does. And it's interesting. I didn't know you could direct it. So that's also good to know. And the other thing I find interesting is that you do vet it, because you have this process and people apply and you vet. It seems like it's a lot more of the money gets directly to where it can help.
It does. We have Toyota as our biggest community support. And when they run a campaign, right on it, you can actually what they call designate. So you can either designate to a community fund, like a general community fund at United Way, or something very specific. Because if you work here in the Cambridge plant, for instance, you may not live here. Mm-hmm. You may not want to give to, you know, just this community fund for Waterloo Region because it's intensely local. So maybe you're going to give it to Brantford, or you're going to give it to Hamilton, or you're going to give it to Guelph or somewhere where you live. We like to see it invested in the community because most people live here and it helps them indirectly. But we certainly designate, and that's always been a model of the United Way.
Well, I mean, it's such an interesting model. This is part of the reason why I had all these questions, because we think of a charity as for X and you give your money. And the model for the United Way is fascinating. I appreciate all the insight you've given us about the United Way, because I really didn't know a lot of it. And I purposely didn't read too much because I wanted to learn from the expert as well. But and we talked a little bit about leadership. Let's talk a little bit more about your leadership. So you mentioned Tiger Brand briefly as your family company that you sold, and so you did the whole thing from start to finish kind of thing. And what were some of the leadership lessons you learned from your time as president of Tiger Brand?
Well, Tiger Brand, or Galt Knitting was it called?
I know, I saw that. I loved that it was I didn't know that it was in a knitting company.
Yes, it was a vertical knitting company. Mm. So it actually knit the fabric for underwear because that's what it made. Wool, itchy, scratchy woolen underwear.
Sounds great.
In 1881. And it was started by my great grandfather and great uncle together, James and Adam Warnock. And they started it with many people in these communities, whether it was Newlands Textiles. So that was Andrew Newland. And there was very many people. And these were a lot of them in the textile field. Hessler Woolens was the Forbes family, like a big bunch of people that made these organizations work because they're built on a river, and the river powered the turbine, which powered the pulleys, which made the machines work. And that's how it went. When I took it over, my father had taken over the company in 1954. My grandfather was lieutenant colonel in the army. So he really, those days, people owned factories. They didn't necessarily run factories. And I was fifth generation and one of six children. So there was lots of work from age 6 and 7 and 8, sweeping floors on. So you never didn't know about the business. You never didn't know how to work inside the business, but I was determined not to. That wasn't going to be my future, nevertheless. That's the laid plans. But I did learn leadership from the people on the shop floor, not just the owners or the, you know, the supervisors or managers. You learn from how people manage from within. And because I was on a sewing machine just like the other ladies. I was folding underwear just like the other ladies. I learned a lot about doing by being on the floor and learning those lessons. But treating people fairly with respect has got to be the biggest thing I learned in almost everything I did, everything. But also about how to take an opportunity and turn it into something. So in 19, if you believe this, I just started, 1978, I took this fabric that had been left over and we had dyed some experimental fleece because fleece had come out of the gym. And t-shirts had come out of the workwear because jeans in the 60s became the thing, right? Denim came right out of the work factories to the street. And that was the revolution in factory, in fashion change. And so we started this little company with this fellow called Cotton Ginny. And we put together this little tiny store, and I mean tiny, 400 square foot store with tops and bottoms matching, yellow, pink, green, blue, you name it, turquoise.
I think I had every color.
But I was able to take, the opportunity was to take something and make it into something else. And I had a factory at my fingertips. How lucky was I? So I was able to turn and create garments out of basically t-shirt material, sweatshirt material, and turn it into a whole bunch of things. But then did tons and tons of private labels. So every Beaver Canoe sweatshirt you ever did see, it came out of that factory in Cambridge.
I had no idea that you worked with Cotton Ginny and Beaver Canoe. I didn't know that. I'm sure most people my age don't know that. And we wore them every
Well, if you had a Roxy sweatshirt, it came from Tiger Brand. So the concept of private label is the same concept of Kirkland over at Costco.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If it was a t-shirt and it was made at a factory in Canada, that's where it was made.
Wow.
The change happened, though, in the late 90s, early 2000s, when China finally got their shipping together and they weren't a 6-month lead and you needed to buy 10,000 of this. We were a custom making shop. We would ship. Mark's Work Warehouse was a big customer. I created the brand Wood River and Denver Hayes for them. We created this whole store concept. We shipped to the stores. Yours would come in on a computer. Today it's normal, but in those days it was pretty innovative. So we're able to keep the company alive. We had computer aided drafting and computer aided cutting, laser cutting, nothing. We invested in machinery, but machinery wasn't going to run textiles in the future. Because labor was the biggest component. We were taken by the steel workers, unionized.
Interesting.
Because there was a lot of people that worked there and it was vulnerable in three different kinds of plants. And Walmart could sell a t-shirt for less money than we could make a t-shirt. So eventually people didn't care about quality. It was a fast runaway, throwaway fashion. And that quality aspect didn't matter. So I knew. I started to do some importing and some manufacturing in Asia myself and started to put it together in what I thought the future-proofing looked like, but my brothers didn't agree. So the difference between my leadership with where I had a vision of where I thought I could and we could take it and survive and create this design, marketing, distribution organization, it wasn't in sync with my fellow partners. So that's why the company was sold. It wasn't going to be sustainable under the model, but there was no other lesson like worrying that you're going to make payroll. There's no other lesson like being frightened that person's not going to pay you for that $2.5 million order that you just shipped. But it wasn't really the best learning I could ever have. And I didn't have the job because of who I was, really. I had the job because of what my ability was, my talent to create something out of nothing. And my father said to my brothers at the time, well, you know, the machinery isn't going to run it in the future. It's all about marketing, communication, fashion design. And my brothers could never, one ran the factory that ran the knitting factory and the dye houses. And then the other one ran the sewing floors.
I can't even imagine how difficult, but also, I mean, also lucky that your dad saw that in you. That's not always the case. So
no, it is not. And my father was a character. He was a real character, but when I was on the board at Conestoga, one of my favorite stories is Frank Hasenfratz called me, and he, of course, was Linamar, and said, hello, this is Frank Hasenfratz. I like to have coffee. It was Frank Hasenfratz anyway. I didn't even know. But John Tibbetts had at the time said, this fellow is going to put this money into this big innovation, you know, training facility. Would you talk to him? Sure, but why? First question, why your father make you president when he had sons? I don't have any boy. I want to know. Well, Linda Hasenfratz is one of the most amazing CEOs you ever.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, it's a good thing he didn't have any boys.
But he was really intrigued because the gender hadn't changed yet, Amy. I'm 72 now. And what was happening then is not the same as what's happening now. What scares me the most is that female leadership hasn't advanced as much as it should have. We still have gender barriers. Women are paid less generally. And we mix that up with longevity because women live longer, especially now in a healthier world. And so we have ageism. There's all kinds of things that, you know, are added to our interesting world that we live in. And I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that our young women leaders that are growing up today learn by their moms, because we didn't have those same moms to learn from. Most of our moms of my generation stayed home. If you think about your grandmother, that was the moms of my generation.
Yeah.
And I learned through that, that you could do anything if you had to, because that was a generation that grew up post-war. They didn't have a lot of things.
No. And I mean, you're right. We have not come as far as probably we would like to see, but I mean, as someone of my age, I am thankful to you and those that came before you for all the work that you've done. I mean, and I was lucky, I had a great model. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, worked all the time. She ran the charcoal steakhouse for years.
That's right. So she did.
I think, you know, I had an interesting role model in that sense, but, and it's just different. The challenges that your generation and the one before faced, they were almost obvious. There isn't enough women here, or there are no women here, or women aren't even getting paid, or they can't open a bank account, or they can't do this. And you and everybody else smashed all of those down to let us sort of move forward. And my challenge is it's more subtle now, because you're right, we have not advanced. And I think it's because it's subtle. It's hard. Where's the mark? Like, what am I fighting now? Because, well, yeah, everybody has a job and everybody's paid, but it's still, the age comes into play and the gender is still there and there's ways to get around it. Nobody overtly says it anymore because they're not allowed to, but it doesn't mean that it's not still there.
No, it's there. My favorite charcoal story was when I first joined, was invited to join the Gore Mutual Board. The chairman took me for lunch at the charcoal steakhouse. And in my wildly crazy world, I had never seen anyone eat a pigtail.
Oh, and really?
So he ordered a pigtail.
Yeah.
And he picked up that thing and ate it. I was so taken aback that after asking me, he said, well, you know, you came from the right family and your great grandfather was the president of the Gore, and, you know, it would be really wonderful to have you continue. And we are looking for a woman. What? You don't have any women on the board? No. I said, well, you know, looking at this fellow, it's very flattering, but no thanks. So he said, okay, well, you're not the only woman that we're talking to. We're talking to a couple of other women. We're talking to Lorna Marsden. And Lorna was the president of Laurier. I went, oh, why would you talk to me and not take her? Which, you know, so she joined the board and came to my office about 3 months later and said, you will join the board with me. That is ridiculous. I am not going to be the only woman on the board. Because that's when women weren't on boards.
No.
And it was just starting to be something that, as long as you had one or two, that's diversity out of 20 people, you know? But that's the early days of breaking those barriers, Amy. That's when we were able to say, just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes women work harder.
Well, we had to work harder to get there. And I mean, the boards that I've been on, you know, it's, yes, you know, now there's no question we have women on the board, but now it's the little things like, well, we should have parity for starters. And it's language. I was on a board where I had to not fight, but remind constantly that we're not going to call it chairman. We're just going to call it chair, and our language and language chair matters. And we have to remove these things.
Change,
and that's the subtlety where it was, it's not a big deal. And I said, well, if it's not a big deal, then let's just change. You know, why does it bother you? You're here. You're lucky to be here. So why are you bothering with these little things, kind of? And my goal is to always leave a board better than I left it in all aspects, but from a gender perspective, that's always the goal I have too.
Well, I like the fact that we try to take the word gender and neutralize it and say that you have a boy and a girl twin. You have twins. You don't have a boy twin and a girl twin. You have twins.
That's right.
And that's the kind of thing that we remind ourselves that is important. But as your generation comes through this next burst, your job as a leader, whether it's in a business context, a family context, an education context, is you're going to try and guide folks, but not tell them what to do.
Joan, this has been such a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for sharing all of your stories. There's so much to learn in each and every one of them. And also, thank you so much for coming on and talking about the United Way and teaching me and hopefully many others how it works and why it's still important to our community. Voices of Leadership is part of the Bespoke Productions Hub network of independent podcasters. If you are interested in partnering with us as a sponsor, or if you have a podcast of your own, please visit bespokeproductionshub.com for more information. This episode is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Amy Schluter.